Yes, you were.
And I finally opened up. What I saw was the water becoming angry and the skies. I was watching as what I thought might be kelp beds, something growing very rapidly under the water. And I got very clearly, the water actually turned red, and I got very clearly that oxygen, there was no oxygen to support life.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wanting to get people out of the area because of whatever this was.
Rena, one question I have for you. Are you on a cell phone or a landline?
Unfortunately, the only thing I have is a cell phone.
Oh, okay, because it's just a little choppy, but we'll work with it.
Okay. And even after I talked about it, they just got worse. And then when everything blew up, I was watching a curve of land. I could see a curve of land and just this huge expanse of water.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized when I saw it on TV that I had seen what was coming from deep water horizon when that happened. And in the last few days, I have been where there's a computer, and I have actually been able to find things that substantiated what I felt and what I believed.
Mm-hmm.
The other concern that I have is that, first off, as I said before, all four major oil corporations had in their contingency plans to save the walruses in the Gulf of Mexico. Now, for the four of them to have the same thing says to me there is an unwritten agreement among all of them. And this information concerning the Lockerbie giant in BP that has come to light in the last few days confirms my feeling, to me at least, that by creating an environmental disaster and an economic disaster, these corporations will then be able to go in and claim that they are helping the people, they are helping the area by drilling and bringing new life, and while they are mining for whatever it is they want to take out, that they will help restore the habitat and give the people an economic lifeline. That's true.
And restoring the land. They're giving them a viable income, a source of living.
They have said before, BP in particular, has said before, they will take care of the people. They will clean this up.
They're very ill, and very few journalists now have access to the medical clinics and facilities.
None of the journalists are able to get into the federal clinic.
Mm-hmm.
There is a lockdown from BP, just as there was with Exxon, on the medical records, on the medical information, and yet there are people, there was over 6,000 of the workers who became seriously ill and have long-term medical issues from the Exxon Valdez incident. And the workers in the Gulf are being exposed to the same thing. I sent you articles I found on, as a matter of fact, it was day before yesterday when I finally got to where there was a computer.
Yes.
There was an activist who came down from Alaska. She actually has a doctorate in marine toxicology, Ricky Ott, O-T-T. And she's told the people in the Gulf that they were in the same position as they were in Alaska. And she said they promised to make us whole and help us financially, but that help never came.
Mm-hmm.
She compared BP's attitude towards the fishermen after she heard of the rig explosion, and she said that the air smells like oil, you can feel it in the back of your throat, walking the shorelines in and around New Orleans, but she said the children and the elderly and sea life would be the most affected by the fulfill, which I had said also, and the unborn.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's all life. Those people, she stated that those mm-hmm. people needed to be evacuated from their homes. They needed to be relocated because they were feeling sick, and she mm-hmm. says they're already having respiratory problems, mm-hmm. nosebleeds,
nausea,
and burning eyes. Mm-hmm. And she says it's the same symptoms that the workers had after the Valdez thing, among others.
And these are just the early symptoms of what you call this toxic soup.
One of the things that the toxic this will create is, I said it was going to damage our central nervous system, the body's ability to take care of itself naturally. I have found an article that confirmed that, and it will increase the incidences of kidney disease, leukemia, and other cancers. There's things there they don't want the people to know.
Yeah.
It's just, it's horrifying.
I know.
And it's supposed to be looked after by the government, but the government is letting BP have fun. They're doing what they want.
Yeah, it's almost as if they're collaborating with them. They're afraid of them, or they've worked with them in this collusion.
I think Obama inherited this, just as he inherited the economic collapse of the housing market and all. But
nonetheless, he, as the president, can do something.
Right. And among other things, they need to study. There needs to be major studies done on what this type of exposure does to human beings. They did not do that study after
the
Valdez.
They're doing the study now. They're the guinea pigs, apparently, if they're doing anything at all.
But no, they're not doing a study. BP has a lockdown. The government has a lockdown on the information. The only ones that are trying to do it are the state government. And BP is not paying them to take care of the people who are going through the mental illnesses caused by the exposure to the oil and the methane gas and the fumes from the dispersants. Now, they've used Colexit, but they've also used other dispersants. And when they start mixing chemicals, they don't have tests to find out what the result of that is, what it will do to life, period. Mm-hmm. So they say there is no need to have suits and such. But that's not true. That's just not true. The workers are saying the same thing in the Gulf States and the people in the Gulf States that the workers in the Valdez cleanup said. And they're all going through this.
Yeah.
And the people have their backs against the wall. BP holds all the cards.
Yeah.
And they are letting people get sick. They don't care. Tony died. He just wants to go back to his life. But the people there will not have their lives. It will take how many years for life to return in a normal way? When the oil is on top of the ocean, it evaporates. It's degraded by sunlight, and it gets consumed by the microbes that will eat it.
Mm-hmm.
And it washes up on the beaches. But this is a humongous, unplanned, but planned in my head.
Hey, can you say a little bit more about unplanned, but planned?
I'm going back to my feeling that there is a collusion on the part the four major oil companies and the dishonest government workers who allowed things to reach this level. They knew at some point there would be an incident like this, and yet they ignored all of the warning signs when they began a month or so before the oil rig blew up.
What were some of the warning signs? I know we spoke about it before, but just to go over them a little bit more.
A big warning sign was when pieces of the cap the original cap, mm-hmm. the blowout preventer, begin to come up in the oil. Now, if you've got pieces of machinery coming up in oil, even in a car, if you start seeing metal pieces in the oil, you know you've got an engine problem. Well, this is how many thousands of feet below, and they see these pieces come up, and the workers report it, and they don't stop and fix it before it becomes a disaster. To me, that is a plan, but according to everyone else, an unplanned event.
Or they're just calling it negligence, despite the lives of the workers.
Negligence is another word for it.
Yeah.
To me, it's back to my belief from what I was given by Spirit, and so far everything I have found online in the last 2 days has confirmed that what they were showing me and telling me is 100% accurate. This is going to go around the world. All of the others in there are also circulating in the waters. It is going to be carried upon the waters, within the waters, and upon the wind. And sooner or later, and it's much sooner, I think, than people expect, we will have a similar event to what Europe experienced with the Industrial Revolution, where they had acid rain falling from the sky because of all the coal burning.
Oh, in England, at the turn of the century.
Yes, and it ate holes in the silk stocking.
Mm.
Now, I know there's people who go have chemical facelifts and all of this, but I'm sorry, I don't think I want one of those chemical facelifts.
No.
I've never had one, but I just don't think that's going to feel too good.
And you had spoken to me a while ago about the DNA. Our DNA is affected for many generations to come.
Yeah, well, that's one of it. There's been over 30 billion barrels of crude oil in 6,000 feet of water. There is thousands of gallons of dispersants that have been dumped. And this is going to, the toxic soup will affect our DNA eventually, just like Agent Orange did.
Mm-hmm.
Agent Orange made many, many of the military and civilian population who were exposed to it. It gave them extreme problems in reproducing, having children, in other words, male or female. And the same thing happened during the Iraq War.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know this for a fact because it affected a couple of members of my family.
Mm-hmm.
It not only affects the veterans, but the offspring, in particular the male, have an extremely low sperm count.
So we stand to lose possibly 40% of all life forms because it's a...
Yes.
It's
the total extinction of 30 to 50% of all life. And I remember today, back, oh God, years ago, for some reason, I got up at 3 in the morning and I started writing something.
Hmm.
And it was very simply, it was, I sit once again looking through the grayness of time.
Hmm.
Once again, I see the people protecting those who can reproduce. Once again, we have to go within in order to survive. And it went on. And I'm wondering if that was actually a forebringer of this happening. This is a major call.
Well,
Everyone's panicking over 2012. 2012 is a great awakening. It is a major change. And we can either start working on correcting it so it's easier on us and all life, or we can allow it to be a major, major upheaval.
Mm-hmm.
They're ignoring the laws of chemistry, and they are just making the undersea plumes, as they're calling them, worse with the dispersants.
It's just an incredible toxicity and waste that should never have been created in the first place.
Right.
That's basic.
The ocean floors, for the most part, have not been explored. They are not sending down submarines to take pictures of the dying sea life. Your coral reefs, your plankton, which most we can't see really without a microscope, unless it's a big piece, but I haven't seen one. All of your life forms are being removed in the areas where those plumes are because of the loss of oxygen.
Yeah.
And I got very clearly that there was a major removal of oxygen where the red was at, and even in where the, what I thought were kelp beds, but I now understand to be plumes in the mm-hmm. bottom of the ocean. You can't see that. You could see that on land, but under the ocean, what are they going to do when the jellyfish are gone?
I know.
Mother Nature, she had a reason to create those, or the god, or whatever you want to say. What's going to happen? They will not survive that. The bluefin tuna that the fishermen count on, that's already endangered, and they will go down. I mean, they will go down,
yeah.
And this is actually confirmed by things I have found.
Well, finally, others are beginning to understand just how precarious life is and how dependent all life forms are on when we are all on one another.
Many people understand, but unfortunately, the government, the congressmen, the senators, those who have the power to make things happen, they just figure they can move their families out of harm's way. Well, I'm sorry. They eat a lot of the same foods we eat.
Breathe the same air.
Mm-hmm. And eventually their money will run out. And eventually they will have to suffer like the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
The sperm whales, the scientists believe that they will be gone. It's just horrible. All of the inhabitants of the mm-hmm. deep, they would be okay with a Valdez-type bill because they don't go up that high. But your marlin, your snapper, your gropers, they all swim way down at the bottom. And the oil plumes, those microscopic beads of oil, will still gunk up, fill up their gills. And then you turn around and you've got that methane gas beside. They were not meant to breathe methane gas.
I know.
Of these zones interact. And they're all being hammered. It's just so unreal that it makes me sick when
and
I start going down into
it. I know,
it.
And it's not just the marine life that's suffering. It's the men, the women that are involved in the cleanup, they're struggling for their breath.
And that
they're
is
getting,
the
and this is just the beginning of their illnesses.
Right. They will have a lifetime of suffering.
Yeah.
We are a larger piece of the biosphere. And if it's making our people sick, it is deadly.
And that's why the press is not allowed to have access to any medical records or to even enter the clinics and see what's going on.
I think so. I really do. The only ones that will allow them in mm-hmm. are the states. And the states have their backs up against the wall because BP isn't paying them. The only way we small people, as one of the lovely BP
CEO
called us, can make a difference is through prayer. Now, I know you remember when I sat down and did a search on Robert's computer on the prayer, trying to understand why I was getting prayer, a prayer chain.
Well, an inner spiritual movement based on, as you were saying, peaceful action.
Yeah, because we need
But
to
action
take,
nonetheless and moving right. forward.
Peaceful action and active meditation.
Mm-hmm.
You're praying, and then you do what you can to lighten the footprint you leave. And you you work towards getting things the same for all life around the world. That's why I sat down finally and got an email address, whitestarprayernet@gmail.com, mm-hmm. so that once a month, all people had to do was go to that site or just be notified, get an email from that site telling them what the topic that affects all life is for that month to pray for.
Yeah.
Because the only way to really make the changes is to start with prayer and then peaceful action mm-hmm. in addition. And prayer can't be taxed. It's not going to cost people any money, but it can help change things immediately. We used it to get Headwaters as a national park here in the U.S. We need to start doing it again where mm-hmm. it's not based on any religious group. It's not based on any political group. It is strictly a call for prayer right. on things that affect all life worldwide.
Yeah.
It will yeah. help preserve the human race mm-hmm. and all of the life. We need these many, many lives around us. It would be a very dull, boring world if it was all one kind of grass, one kind of tree, one kind of flower, one animal,
yeah.
If we all looked the same. There is a diversity for a reason.
And I don't think the press is doing a decent job of alarming people to how wide this will spread, the toxicity in the air, as the winds move it and the oceans continue to flow, the currents, how far and wide it's capable of destroying life.
Some of the stations will touch on it lightly,
CNN,
but I have seen this
somewhat.
Actually moving in and touching life as far as Europe and possibly even into Asia. Mm. It will affect all life around the world.
It's really scary, and people don't realize the severity of it. And they're
You've got your migrating animals that will pass through these undersea currents. And they're going to be bombarded with these oil particles and the methane gas particles and the dispersant particles. And they are going to be turning up everywhere. As that accumulates in their body, we will eat them. Many people will end up eating them and taking into their bodies the poisons that those animals had taken in. Mm. There was a problem, and the eagles are a prime example, where the eagles were eating the animals that had been shot with lead bullets, and they were dying in your condors from lead poisoning.
Yep.
There is a reason
They're
that we need to
back.
Look and learn from history. And this country needs to realize that if it's going to truly be a democracy, that they need to honor their treaties that they have made with all of the indigenous people, mm-hmm. and that there's, when you get through sorting out all of the spiritual laws, you find out they come down to common themes. I don't care what religion you look at, 9 times out of 10, they're going to have the same common take care of one another, treat one another with respect, take care of the earth. Having dominion over doesn't mean you can go out and beat up the earth. It means you are responsible for taking care of it and its inhabitants.
Exactly.
And we need to make the same physical laws around the world. That was part of what United Nations was supposed to do, I thought. But
wow.
It's not so, and they are not. These oil companies, among other chemical polluters, are not cleaning up the messes. They leave the messes there, and they become the dead land.
Yeah.
And in Alaska, where they had 552 major oil spills on land, in 1985, all BP lines, All BP, just BP, is that they alone had 552 incidents. That
552 oil, incidents on land that was never cleaned up?
Right. That oil carried heavy metals into the water table. Now, you have the animals that are dependent upon that. They are impacted. There's a high mortality rate now and a high birth defect rate. They haven't done the studies on the humans. But if you look back at history, it's a repeat of what the government did with the radioactive tailings from the mines when they were mining for uranium. They actually just disposed of them on Native American land and carried on the dust. And the Hopi and your Navajo Nation has the highest rate of birth defects from this. Now, they actually use those radioactive mining tailings for schoolyards, homes, city settlements. There is more than one way to reduce your overhead by reducing the population. And I understand that we have a major economic crisis. This is why people need to start doing edible gardening, using companion plants
gardening
with their vegetables to help have beneficial plants. Those who can start having beehives, keeping beehives. There is so many things that we as humans need to do actively and in prayer. If everyone prayed at least once a day for these things to get better, all life is sacred, not just one small group, not just one life form. All life.
And Rena, you were speaking about the tribes. And what do you know about the tribes in Louisiana? I know we spoke about the United Houma Nation and how they're being impacted. And I understand that they're not federally recognized, so they're not even getting federal funds to help in the cleanup. They are state recognized, but not federally.
Okay, first off, everyone assumes that when the BIA gets this huge amount of money, that that is all going to be divided among the Native Americans. No. They get what is left over. Left over.
Oh, their salaries need to be paid first.
Right. The
bureaucracy.
BIA takes out all of their operating expenses first. And there is millions of dollars that has not been paid to nations because of BIA mismanagement. They cannot even
say a lot
fund
about that.
It. It's been misplaced. Now, your tribes down there.
I'm also speaking about Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, and Florida.
You've got all of those.
Where
nations,
are you from?
Yeah, and you've got all of those nations being impacted. Their livelihood, their health. The United Houma are in danger of losing what small piece of land they have left.
Now, where are they exactly located? Where is that tribe?
They're actually on a small island. Well, it's a small island now. It was originally larger, however, the dredging or sand and such that the government needed for other projects has greatly reduced it. And then, of course, your hurricanes. And that's another subject totally where they got totally missed. There was no news concerning how badly those tribes were impacted by the hurricane. Hurricane Katrina just devastated many of the nations. Your Biloxi, I can't remember the last part of their name, but that nation, they are losing everything, and their people are fishermen.
And they're from Mississippi?
The Biloxi, Louisiana.
Oh,
that might be Mississippi. All I'm hearing right now is that with them being fishermen mm-hmm. and the families losing their oyster beds and all of their shrimp fishing, just all of their hunting grounds, basically, that is just being totally removed. And these hurricanes, when they come in, mm-hmm. that whips up the water, and that's going to carry water and oil onto the plant life.
And they're already losing so much of what land they have, and now it's so poisonous, and well as their livelihoods, tourism, yeah. fishermen, and some do actually work for BP.
Some do work for BP, and if they tell...
And they're being impacted culturally.
Public,
I'm sorry?
If they talk to the public, they're fired.
Yeah.
And it is just unreal, the stranglehold that these oil companies have on the people, on their health, and on the government officials.
Yeah.
They operate as if they are a monarchy. They have kings and queens.
Yeah.
And the ones who suffer are the small people.
And the tribes have lived sustainably for thousands of years on the land.
Yeah.
And it's been a whole way of life. And that culturally also is being destroyed if they have to evacuate and disperse.
Right.
They're struggling to maintain it. And very few are aware of that. What can we do?
Prayer.
Yeah.
And lending a helping hand, no matter how small.
Speaking about it, letting people know, alerting them to this fact. I'm going to find out what tribes are actually down there.
Oh, there are so many. There's the Seminole. There's the Choctaw.
Yeah.
You can go online and you can
Muskogee.
Look. Yeah.
Yeah.
The Muskogee, the Creek, they're all in there.
And there's the
tribes in Texas.
Oh, yes.
And they're being impacted. Anyone that can smell and taste the oil is in immediate danger. It will affect their mental condition, depression. If you think about it, when people start sniffing gas, it destroys the brain, right?
Yes.
They're sniffing gas.
Yes, yeah.
Now, your mental illnesses are going to get worse. Depression's going to get worse.
Oh, sure.
Suicide rate is going to go up. That's the first thing. And the suicide rate will go up just simply because of everything that's going on. Then you have the health deterioration, and that increases suicide rates. Then you have the long-term effects of everything costing too much because you can't get enough of it.
Mm-hmm.
Demand drives up price. So what was a dollar becomes $10, theoretically speaking.
Mm.
And you don't have enough. You were short on being able to buy everything you needed at a dollar. How much are you going to be able to buy when it goes to 10? That's going to make depression worse. The cancer, you can go right down through it. Leukemia, one of the hardest ones, is going to be hit. It's going to be a major one because this stuff attacks the liver. Go ahead.
And this is all in the midst of watching your whole life deteriorate in front of you, what you've loved, the oceans.
Yeah. These people, they've lost. One family had oyster beds for over 135 years. And the father point blank said, "What heritage do I have left I can give my children?" It's school starting in just 2 months. How many of these people are trying to put children through college? How many of them are going to have clothing and school supplies? It doesn't make any difference where you look or what color someone is, what color their hair is or their eyes. When it comes down to it, all the Creator looks at is the color of your heart.
Yeah.
What did you do to help all life?
Right. And someone the other night on television was talking about the harbor seals, and he said they were looking like they were drunk and dying. An autopsy showed brain lesions. What are we exposing these fishermen and beings to?
It's really a nightmare. It's a nightmare created by greed. And that is bottom line. It's a nightmare created by greed. There's actually an article that was written in, I think it was Newsweek, where they talked about the inability to reach the federal health officials. And everyone's questioning, why this blackout? Why this news blackout?
And that really started, well, it's been ongoing, but 3 weeks ago that was intensified. For safety reasons, I understand. They didn't want the journalists or reporters going in because they may get sick, yet they don't care about the workers and, you know, they're...
You know, the big problem is, I think, that they didn't want anyone to know that a chemical, 2-butoxyethanol has been detected in over 20% of the offshore responders and 15% of those near the shoreline.
Wow.
It's above the 5 parts per milliliter limit set by the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health. It was in the Times. And NOSHA, the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health standard, is considered safer, but it's not enforceable by law. Well, normally, BP will use this outfit limits, but in this case, they quoted the limit from the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, which were higher because it made their people look fine. I mean, and that COEXIT is actually COEXIT 9527. It's unreal what they're doing to the people and to the
life.
And
the distortion of the facts and figures and the data.
Yeah.
I haven't read, I have to look into it more, but it makes sense to me that's how they're skirting their accountability and their fines, minimizing them as best they can.
But they actually pick and choose what studies, the ones that will make them look the better. And the Exxon crude or the flu or cold that Exxon did not have to report to the federal health officials. Well, there's an attorney called Mestis, M-E-S-T-A-S.
Mm-hmm.
He said they never looked at any medical records which were controlled by Exxon.
And, so many similarities between the two accidents. Accidents.
The similarities are that the nosebleeds, the irritation, the skin irritation, the throat irritation, and upper and respiratory illnesses, nausea, vomiting.
And then the cover-ups by Exxon and BP as well, the distortion of the truth.
And the lack of
any real effort to clean up or take accountability or to show any true remorse for what has happened. They're proceeding as life, as they've always lived it.
They're proceeding as if this will never touch them and theirs, but it will. There was actually a Vietnam veteran. He was a captain of a ship, and he said that his men were accidentally dosed with some dispersants, and it required his people to go to the hospital. He said it was just like Agent Orange.
Mm.
he compared it to Agent Orange.
Did it eat into their skin and burn?
Yes, it irritates. It makes a rash.
Uh-huh.
If you go out and you pick up, say you pick up stinging nettles.
Yes.
It's a rash like that, and it stings and it burns.
Rena, what herbal remedies are there? Are there any herbal remedies for some of these toxic chemicals that the people are ingesting? And
old favorite standbys.
Yeah.
You find that milk thistle is one of those. That helps to detox the liver. And a lot of people don't realize that your milk thistle is the same family as your artichokes. So when they're eating artichokes, they get a little milder dose, but it still helps the liver to heal and regenerate and detox. Now, red clover helps with rebuilding the blood, but it just depends on what is really going on with that person.
Yeah.
We could suggest Slippery Elm or the throat, or whatever, or cherry bark. But unless you're looking at the person, because that stuff is insidious, and it affects everyone physically and mentally.
And does it attack their weakness initially?
If you've got a predisposition towards certain things due to hereditary, it's very high. I'm getting very much, yes, it will help bring out a disease or a family illness. It will help make that work.
But milk thistle, as a rule, is recommended because it does start cleaning out the liver, detoxifying it.
Right. And then you've got to strengthen the heart. Now, hawthorn will strengthen the heart.
The heart.
But most people don't realize that's what circulates everything. Don't realize that you also need horse chestnut, and I recommend that people get that as an extract or a pill, because that helps to put the elasticity back into the blood veins so they can expand and contract. And if you use hibiscus flowers, that will help clean out the plaque. So that might help remove some of the oil.
But they need to get these herbs from outside of their area because they're already impacted. It's landed on them.
The herbs are in a bottle, or if they're in a closed container that is non-permeable. Now, plastic breathes, so I'm kind of concerned, and I'm getting a feeling, no, they need to be in glass or metal to protect them. And then there is the herbs for the skin. There is things that could be done herbally to help that would work well with modern Western medicine and not create any conflict. But until these people are removed from that area, all you're doing is putting a salve on a bad situation.
Yeah. That I was afraid of. They do need to get out.
Right. We were not meant to be used as guinea pigs. No life form was meant to be used as guinea pigs.
But there again, the suicide and the severe depression of being forced to leave all that you've ever known and loved is devastating.
Being forced to leave their land.
And our whole cultural way of life as well.
Make any difference whether you're Native American, Irish, or whatnot down there. Most of us are a mix anyway of different from different countries. This land is a melting pot for a reason. But we are not supposed to melt into the earth. Not before our time. And this stuff will literally take life down.
Yeah.
Literally remove it. As we know and understand it.
It's very serious.
And I start looking and I start getting sick again. You know how sick I got physically, and I'm not the only one that had near-death experience. experiences behind this. There was a lot of the people who had near-death experiences who were seeing this before it happened. Barbara Pentel was speaking about it on your show.
Mm-hmm. Yes, she was. I just want to say to those of you just tuning in, you're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM, and this is Tickling the Belly of the Beast. I'm Janaea, and I'm speaking with Rena White Star. She's an Indigenous elder, and we're talking about the horrendous consequences of the Gulf oil disaster and what we can do about it and just how extensive it is.
I just found one of the articles I printed out, and BP has dumped more than 185,000 gallons of dispersant into the wellhead, plus 800,000 on the surface. And the toxic brew of crude with dissolved methane, it actually stretches, one of them is over 15 miles long, greater than 5 miles wide, and 306 feet. That one was detected by a ship called the Pelican. And then another one is over 22 miles long, over 6 miles wide, and it is over 3,000 feet thick. And that does come to the surface of the ocean. And this was found by the University of South Florida researchers. They were aboard the Weatherbird 2. So, and these plumes, you can't see them really because it's microscopic. But again, the animals swimming through it will become sick, will become toxic. The wildlife that is below on the surface of the ocean and below the ocean will die. It can settle into pools like a blanket and stop the carbon dioxide gas exchanges for that area, which means your dying animals, your dead animals will fall into a heap and become stagnant. They'll just lay there because there will be nothing to clean them up.
Yeah.
And we all know what stagnant ponds become.
Kind of like BP itself, soulless and stagnant and fearless. Heartless.
They're heartless. They have
exactly.
No concern.
And that's why they don't care. What they're doing is what they are, and that's all they know. And that's why their actions speak
all
for themselves about that.
Their God is the almighty green dollar.
Mm-hmm.
That is their God. We're going to go in, and we're going to make as much money as we can off of these people's backs, and we don't care what happens to them. Their attitude is the same as Marie Antoinette. But instead of giving them cake to eat, they want to give them oil to eat and drink because, they're expendable. It's just, there'll be more people come in. They'll take their places because they need the money to take care of their family.
They're up against the wall.
Right. Right.
They've lost their livelihoods.
And at some point, very soon, nature will not be able to clean up behind man. There's already areas where we see that, where nature is not able to clean up the messes that the two-leggeds have left.
Mm-hmm. There are already many dead zones in the ocean. I really don't know where they are, but that's what I've heard.
Well, we're dumping uranium waste down there. Now we're dumping oil down there in very large amounts. Very large amounts. And why? It didn't need to happen. It doesn't need to happen. It should not be. The warning was there.
Mm-hmm.
It's up to the people to take control, to take responsibility, to
demand the change.
And begin to change and to begin praying every day about all life, for all life. For all life is sacred, that known and unknown, that seen and unseen. We don't see our mother as a star because we walked upon her. Those little green men of Mars don't see Mars as a star because they walk on Mars.
Right.
But we're part of the universe.
Yeah.
We are responsible, and we are the only ones who are making this kind of toxic mess.
And have to be accountable.
We are the two-legged dinosaurs.
Yep.
And we are going to suffer the same fate as the dinosaurs if we don't start in doing prayer every day for all life. If we don't start being concerned about the people around us and next to us, we don't have to go to Louisiana or Florida, but we can start by helping even the animals. Someone was talking to me yesterday about the dogs and the cats and all the animals, all the pets people are having to give up.
Because they can't afford to keep them, or they're getting sick as... Oh.
They cannot afford to keep these animals, and these animals are going to be getting sick because they're drinking the same water as the people. Heavy metals will be in it. Toxins will be in it. And, you know, when you're already stressed out, the last thing you have left is your pets. And it's really hard for children to understand. You have to give them up. I have a great-grandson who still cries for his dog that died. Now, that was a natural thing. But to see your animal be given to the SPCA...
Because you can't afford to keep it.
That is horrible for anyone at any age. How many of the elders are having to give up that animal?
And their horses.
How many of these... they have nothing to do with the mess that's created. But they're suffering now. They don't understand why they've been thrown away. We're such a disposable society that we think it's okay to throw away our elders.
And no one can tell me that animals don't have feelings and emotions. I watch the two pups next door, and they're so jealous of one another. They're precious. That's just one example, but...
Yeah, they remember.
They certainly do.
And they feel...
Deeply.
If you look at an animal that's in a good family, that animal is serene. Usually it's protective, but at the same time, it is not vicious. It is not afraid.
No, it's dearly loved, and it responds in kind.
Right.
And less threatened. There's and it can smell the fear a mile away, or the hidden... Yeah.
The dog that one of my great grandsons still cries for was a yellow lab.
Oh.
And if he could see or hear a child, that child belonged to him. You did not think of raising your voice or raising your hand even. And I have a very close friend who learned that. Now, the dog didn't bite him, but he caught his wrist in his mouth looked at him straight in the eye, and that was after three warnings, and the guy decided he was not going to discipline his grandchild.
No, our animal companions truly are companions, regardless of how we're feeling. They're there and very much aware of it if they're treated well.
Right. Now, we knew he had been mistreated because he was afraid of a stick or a broom in your hand when he first came to us. But after he'd been with us about 3 months, he understood he was not going to be harmed. Animals are intelligent, and they are very, very loving if you are willing to spend the time. Yeah, they've all got their personalities, but humans do too.
Yeah, we certainly do. And you were saying that a lot of the residents down south are being forced to let go of their pets because they can't afford to keep them anymore, and they're probably getting sick as well.
If they're not getting sick,
air
in the
water. Yeah.
And they're smaller than most humans, so they're going to feel it sooner than we are. If we look at the life forms that we consider lower than us, as fools, with that far foolish egos, and we see changes, we see them dying, we'd better listen up, because that is a big call.
It's our future.
We are on the list.
The old canary in the coal mine.
Right.
The first to be impacted by a potential poison.
It was the gas. They would die, and if they died, the miners knew to get out. And people just have to start praying and taking action, positive, peaceful action to help correct and bring things back into balance. They help one another, and they help the other life forms. I don't understand why there is not dog food companies and cat food companies down there giving away food to owners of cats.
Oh, yes.
I don't understand.
It's sent down.
Yeah. They make enough money. This, to me, would make sense. If Tide can put together an outfit, a big rig to go down and wash clothes for people where there's been a major disaster, why can't these outfits who have all of this money do the same to help the animals?
Yeah. They certainly can.
And help the people that live down there. These food companies, they make billions of dollars. They throw away food that is out of date. Well, if it's going to be out of date in, say, 6 months, take it down. Take it to where it's needed. Take it to a food bank. Look after one another. 3 months before, if nothing else, take it.
Have massive shipments sent down to...
Yeah.
The local shelter, animal shelter.
Right.
And then people can pick up the food for their animals.
Yeah. With no blooming red tape.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sorry, but Tony Howard and all of the big wigs in BP are not going to stoop to go down and get something like that for their animals. I'm not worried about the few who are greedy. My prayers are for the many. That are desperate.
And they are desperate. And the stories will probably be told in the not-too-distant future.
The stories
when people
will
demand to know what the truth is.
They will come out slowly over the years ahead of us because many of the illnesses will not be really related directly to the oil spill and kill. So many people have that. It's just like it's ground zero. When the World Trade Center went down, the government was saying the air was safe to breathe. It is fine. A few years later, we learned that these responders, these people that went in to help, the people who were exposed to all of those poison gases in the air and the everything, they're sick, but it took them a couple of years to realize, wait a minute, this is a pattern. This is related to the World Trade Center bombing when the Twin Towers went down.
You know, I wondered about that at the time, just how poisonous the air was and how it would impact the people.
That's what they're going to finally realize behind this. But it will take them years to come clean about it is maybe a better way to put it. Just because they know it will happen, if they look back at the Valdez, they will find that
the same things.
Trail.
Yeah.
But they don't want to. It's
and
not in their best financial interest.
Oh, absolutely not. Their bottom line will be heavily impacted.
Right. And the government wants the money from this outfit and the other outfits, and at the same time, they need to take responsibility for the people. If we are not small.
That's not happening.
We are bigger than them. There's more of us. And if we take charge by prayer and positive active meditation actions, then we can make a difference. We can get things rolling.
Yeah, and it needs to happen. And it yeah.
Yeah, and this cleanup needs to not only happen here. We can't be satisfied with just having good laws for this country. We have to work and see to it that it's enforced and enacted around the world to protect all life.
And the way things are looking now, I imagine some third world nations probably have better standards than we do presently.
Unfortunately, many of them do not. Nigeria, I think it is, the people, the indigenous people of that land call a zone a dead land because of an oil spill there. And the indigenous people say that the oil is on their bodies and in their bodies, but no one has cleaned it. They do not, your third world countries just do not have the clout to do it politically. Whereas if we all start praying on one thing for a month and then go to a new focus for a month, we can get the ball rolling if we start praying and taking positive action. And that's what whitestarprayernet@gmail.com
is about.
Is focused on.
And what, though, we lack is a closeness to the land, an understanding and a deep intuition as to what to do to start salvaging and healing. I'm
the
afraid.
Intuition needs to be there, yes, to a degree. But anyone with common sense can read and learn and act responsibly.
Unfortunately, I'm encountering, though, a lack of will to do anything. People denying the seriousness of what's actually happened. Yes, it's heavy, and yet it lulls them into a false sense of safety. It can't be that bad. The government will take care of it. You know, I'm not seeing a real backbone come forward yet. That may change.
When people begin to be impacted by something, then they see a need for change. Right now, they're all being brainwashed by the televisions and the buy me commercials.
Make
me remember Saturday Night Live. They had an old skit with the Coneheads where the Coneheads would do, as they called it, conspicuous consumption. We are encouraged to acquire more and to put on blinders by the government and not see the needs of others. Mm-hmm. When it begins to impact us or the upper echelon, the wealthy ones, then action begins. And a prime example is the drug issues. Until the drugs reach from the lower society into the middle and on up to the upper, it was not considered a problem. When it began affecting the upper echelon and their families, then the drugs become a problem. Mm-hmm. Alcohol, drugs, they've all
selective
been used
problem.
To undermine and control the people. If you look at the past, you see the pattern of how they are used to manipulate others. Mm-hmm. And that helps you to begin to break the chains that bind you.
Mm-hmm. And see
you
where
see
to take action differently.
And
take action differently.
Right. Now they have all these rehab centers. They didn't need them before because they didn't admit there was a problem. There was a few of them that had drinking problems.
But of course, there are tiers, there are levels of quality of care.
Right.
And some, I think, are just revolving doors.
Some is not really quality care. It's called, well, we will maintain you status quo so that the drug companies make their money and we make our money. We don't really want you to get well. Mm-hmm. We want to control your symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the difference between Western chemical medication and your herbal. And with the chemical medication, unfortunately, people have their impatience that I want it now. Mm-hmm. Well, with the herbal, it takes longer and it's slower, mm-hmm. but it's all the way through. It's not just a quick fix covering up the source of the symptoms and the issues. If you have heart trouble, well, we're going to give you this pill. Okay.
Which impacts other organs as well.
Right, including the liver again, which is why people really need to do
a detox. And that's why
there
are antidotes for
right.
Take care of the antidotes of other medications. Rena, I'm going to have to end pretty soon. I'm not sure where the next guests are, and I suspect they're lost out there.
I know that feeling. Well,
I know you do.
I asked for people to go to White Star Prayer Net, WHITESTARPRAYER, at Prayer Net, PRAYERNET, at gmail.com. It's not going to cost money. Nobody wants any money. We just want people to take a common denominator that affects everyone and pray on that. And right now, it is, of course, the golf oil spill.
Yeah.
So actually, starting August, I'll have the first one ready to go out, and I'll just do a group email on the focal point. And I also ask that the people email me at that address mm-hmm. so that if there's something in their area they're aware of, we may take that.
And will you be publishing any remedies for toxic spills or any chemical exposure? You mentioned milk thistle.
I can give some basic guidelines, yes.
That's always helpful.
Each
different
person,
medicines.
Yeah. Let's say that it's their kidneys that are affected. Well, then you need watermelon seed tea, corn mm-hmm. silk. There's different ones again. And it's almost, you've got your basics, and then you've got the ones that are specific for that person.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to use, for example, Valium is addictive. Valium kills. The plant they derived that from is valerian.
Mm-hmm.
Valerian tea will not kill you, is non-addictive. It'll just help you rest. Now, people could take as much of that as they wanted, and all they're going to do is get a good night's rest.
Yeah.
And it is not a poison, but they took the chemical constituents of valerian
mm-hmm.
and they created Valium. They messed with Mother Nature's balance. And they, therefore, made it a habit-forming drug.
Yeah.
Now, it will work, but we have to be willing to let it work. And one of the things is, let's say you're going to detox the liver. I would say take milk thistle, double whatever the dose the bottle says
mm-hmm.
for a month, and then get the red clover.
Mm-hmm.
Double that dose. There's a difference between a therapeutic and a maintenance dose. And you just take them and you go one at a time with them and you alternate, because our bodies will do the same thing with the herb that mm-hmm. it does with the chemicals. After a while, it's not as effective.
true. And Rena, I'm going to have you on again and talk about a lot of the remedies that you know about. You're an amazing medicine woman as well.
Thank you.
So, you're welcome. And I believe my guests are somewhere out there.
I'm
getting a phone call on my cell phone, so I do have to wrap it up now. But again, thank you, Rena.
Thank you, hon. You take care, Janaea.
You bet.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Well, that was Rena Whitestar. And she actually is Cherokee and Choctaw and is very concerned because it's her land. And I'm going to put on, let's see, Warriors on the Way.
A dragon's eye, but light like a feather. And way across the horizon, deep in the hills, thunder is coming, echoing valley. An elven king, gentle, his master moves in robes of wind. And the poet on your breath, sweeter than peaches, bitter as grandfather time, may slip past you in a rhythm and shadow. But it's received between the lines. Liddy, 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 liddy. Hey, ah, ho, ka, hey. Liddy, 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 liddy. Ring them bells, child. Ring them bells, child. No place like home, no place like home, and there's no place like home. Ring them bells for life, there's no place like home. Thank you. Circled by moon, I circle the sun. I am as they are one. Footprints stretch on here forever. Footprints behind us together. Many eyes have beheld this hallowed ground. In Lakesh, in Lakesh, the only sound. Ooh.
Good afternoon, and you're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM and online. That's www.freakradio.org. And if you like what you're listening to, please, we need donations. You can send them to P.O. Box 7811, Santa Cruz 95061, and that's Free Radio Santa Cruz. And you're still listening to Tickling the Belly of the Beast from the Heartland of Santa Cruz. And for the final hour, I'm real excited to be with Vivian B. Vatican. She is the Director of Education with the Sustainable Living Center, and that actually encompasses two separate programs. And one is PICA, and that is the program in community and agroecology. And there's a network, FOCAN, that is part of that as well. And she's going to be giving us an overview and then going into many projects that they're involved in and the incredible work that they're doing. Welcome. How are you? Oh, you're welcome. First thing I want to ask you is just, hope we can hear this here, an overview of PICA and then how you got involved.
Sure. So PICA stands for the Program in Community and Agroecology, and we basically have a bunch of different components or facets to it.
Why don't you try this speaker here, that one.
Okay.
Whoops. Sorry about that.
Is that better?
Yes, much better.
Okay. So there's an academic component that's connected to classes at UCSC.
Uh-huh.
So we have a seminar that's through Environmental Studies, 91 and 191F. And the focus of the seminar is basically looking at food systems and sustainability within food systems. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, usually a textbook that gets read each quarter. The focus changes each quarter depending on the season, of course. And then students learn different skills, garden skills. And then, of course, we have a community meal as part of the class as well. So it's
a community meal?
Yeah.
Is that, how often is that?
So the class meets once a week on Thursdays. It's a three-hour class. So usually how it works is we have about 40 students in there.
Mm-hmm.
And I have some of the students that live in the PICA residential community, which I'll talk about later.
Sure.
And they help lead some of the gardening groups and the work groups. So we'll meet. We go out into the garden. We teach some sort of garden concept, be that, you know, why do we cover crop? Why is it important to maintain soil fertility? You know, what's the composting system here? Something like that. And then we break up into small groups, and the students get to engage hands-on in the garden and learn those skills and practice them. And they're learning from other students, so it's actually really cool.
What skills to learn?
Yeah, yeah, definitely, you know, and it's interesting because, you know, we do have a lot of, like, environmental studies students that are interested in food and in sustainability, but we also get a lot mm-hmm. of people that don't have any experience with that, and it's maybe their
it's
first
a break
time.
From studies.
Yeah, you know, people that want to just, like, get out of the classroom, mm-hmm. and then they actually realize that it's something meaningful, and it's something that they want to pursue and continue in their lives, which is super inspiring for me. I see students all the time around town that have taken the class, and they're like, wow, you know, this has changed my life, and now I grow a lot of food, and I share meals with my friends, and, you know, I'm really interested in teaching people, and So I feel
so it becomes a whole lifestyle change for them.
It really does. Yeah, you know, it's, and for me too, I think a lot of students, you know, they come in and as part of the community meal, folks cook for 40 people. They get in small groups and they cook a meal. They tell the story about the meal and then we share in it. And for a lot of students,
that's the Thursday meal.
Mm-hmm. And for a lot of students, wonderful, they've never done that, right? To cook for 40 people. And so
one student or?
It's a group. So there's usually about maybe like 4 or 5 students in a cook team. And they share their story about what they made and why they chose it. Sometimes it's, you know, an old family recipe or something that they grew themselves or, you know, there's all sorts of really cool stories that come out. And I think it's really empowering for students.
Oh, for sure.
You know, to be able to share that. And
not
also,
just making it, but talking about what went into the preparation, mm-hmm, of it, mm-hmm, and the,
yeah,
nutrients of watching whatever it is you're growing become a part of your meal,
mm-hmm,
and then your family background, your culture, why you chose that meal.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, I certainly have students that come to me later and they're like, you know, when I was growing up, I wasn't at all interested in, you know, the Korean food that my mom made. And, you know, now I go back and I want to learn those things and I want to be able to make them and share them with other people. And I think it's really wonderful. Food is such a wonderful connector.
And you're making healthy variety. It is a wonderful connector.
Yeah. So I think it's, you know, it's a great way to bring people together, to share our stories and our histories, our cultures, our passions.
Yes.
And yeah, to just take care of each other.
And so, it's how we lived at one point, much closer to the land. I was just talking about it with our last guest.
Mm-hmm.
What that gives, but what we get back from working closely on the land, getting our hands dirty and turning off our minds for a while.
Yeah, yeah, or turning them on in different ways, you know,
yes,
like being outside and listening to birds and, you know, looking at the blue sky and like
feeling that wind.
Yeah, it's
or rain.
Yeah, it's
and
great.
Watching everything grow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
around
like right
you.
Now, outside my office window, we have corn growing. And every day I come in, it's like a little bit bigger. And, you know, I think about the fall, you know, just the whole cycle of, yeah, harvesting that corn with my students and then, you know, grinding the corn and making tortillas and saving the seeds and planting it again for the next year. And, you know, I think there's a lot of cycles that happen there, you know, the students passing on their knowledge and their skills and... So.
How did the program get started? It's wonderful.
Yeah, so I, when I was a student at UCSC, it didn't exist. It got started in 2002. Steve Gleisman, who's a professor of agroecology up on campus, when I was a student, he had this vision. He was like, oh yeah, you know, down in the quarry, I want to bring students down here. I want to have like a living learning program where community happens and students are able to take what they learn from the classroom and really apply it. And he made it happen. You know, my understanding is that, so where College 9 and 10 is right now, mm-hmm, there used to be these portables. And so when they built College 9 and 10, they didn't know what to do with these buildings and they sat on the road for a really long time. And I guess they decided, well, let's do more housing. We have more students coming. And so they decided to do the housing down in the village, the current site of the village in the uh-huh, in the quarry. So before it was just this old quarry. There is, I don't know if you're familiar, there's the Peregrine Falcon. It was like this program to bring back.
I am somewhat familiar,
yeah,
with it. And it's come back.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So there was the program down there in the quarry, and there used to be these buildings where they keep the birds, and but that was sort of abandoned for a long time, and Steve had some offices down there, and so when they decided to move the buildings down and do housing down there, mm-hmm, I think he basically was able to...
It was his opportunity to jump in and create his vision.
Exactly, exactly. And yeah, I've seen old pictures of how the garden got started and, you know, groups of students coming in and cover cropping it and building the fence,
wow,
and just people coming together to plant things in the ground. It's really beautiful.
It really, and this started out as a quarry, so
mm-hmm,
they had to chip away literally at the stones.
Yeah, so it was a limestone quarry, mm-hmm, and I think back in the day, they were taking the limestone, and it was part of rebuilding San Francisco after the earthquake.
Oh.
I'm pretty sure that's the story. There wasn't any, like, machinery or active kind of quarrying happening when I was down there as a student, but, you know, you could see basically just these giant, it's like a giant wall of limestone, a little depression down there, and so out of that, you know, we're growing gardens.
It's amazing. And how, to what extent can the students actually participate, and in what ways? And I would like to learn a little bit more about
sure.
The internships and the international connections, mm-hmm. and the fact that apparently in these internships, students travel throughout the world, and mm-hmm. they work with farmers. They collaborate together. It's not going in and showing them what they know.
Right.
They're learning from the farmers that they're working with. Was it a program in Kwantung? Quentin Rue.
Oh, Quintana Roo?
Quintana Roo.
Uh-huh, that's a new one, yeah. So.
And then Nicaragua.
Yeah.
Costa Rica.
Mm-hmm. So ways for students to get involved, there are many. So, of course, like I mentioned, there's the seminar class. There's also a new focus in environmental education.
Mm-hmm.
So we're doing some classes around that, sort of preparing young people, so preparing students to go out and teach, either in the garden or in classrooms. Around the environment and around sustainability. So those courses, there's internships.
Mm-hmm.
So there's internships with CAN, the Community Agroecology Network, and that's the main focus of the international internship piece. And then we do also local internships. So with school gardens, this past year, I had some students run an after-school garden program in Watsonville at Calabasas Elementary School. So we're hoping to continue that this next year. And what else? I also teach internships up at PICA, garden skills related. So if somebody just wants to learn how to...
I'll sign up.
Yeah, you should come. It's fun. I teach garden skills, but it's also, for me, there's this piece of community around it, too. So, mm-hmm. yeah. So there's internships, classes. What else is there? We also collaborate with, like, other student groups on campus. So we have groups that come down and do projects at PICA. I don't know if you've heard of ESLP. It's the Education for Sustainable Living program.
No, I haven't.
So it's a program on campus, and it's totally student-run. So it's classes and also lectures. It happens in the spring. I think there's like 400 students that take the course. So they do Monday night lectures, but then they have student leaders that break out into smaller groups, and they teach, you know, whatever they're interested in. They come up with a topic.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, two groups that have come down to PICA, one has been on green building, and they did a water catchment system, like a rainwater catchment system on one of our buildings.
How does that work?
So it basically just takes the water that, falls on the roof, and generally it just goes into the gutters and then out onto the pavement and into the ocean.
And is it filtered?
So there's a small kind of like it's like they call it, I think they call it like a leaf catcher. So like sort of big pieces get caught. So it gets filtered in one sort of like one way. It's not where it's drinkable water. So we use it for watering our plants and for irrigation mostly. So it gets collected, and then it goes down into basically a giant container. And at the bottom of that container is a faucet, a spigot. And we just hook up our hoses to it. And because, here in Santa Cruz, it doesn't rain during the summer. So it's really nice to have, you know,
or
that
sometimes
extra.
Much during the winter.
Yeah, except for this winter.
I know it.
But it is nice, you know, to have that extra water for my landscape, you know, the landscape plants that we have around there that we use to, say, attract beneficial insects or pollinators and things like that. So the stuff that we collect from the roof, we don't use for our edible food crops. It's mostly just for our landscape plants.
And that saves a lot in the water bill and our water, mm-hmm. period.
Yeah. And another group we had recently come, they built an herb spiral. So hopefully you'll come back and, walk around and visit.
Oh, I definitely plan to. I got lost on campus. This is how I met this lovely woman. And just ended up lost and found this amazing garden and was very intrigued and wanted to learn more. Everyone looked so refreshed and really happy doing what they were doing, and the ground was beautiful. And then I started learning about it a bit more, and I just said, I really want to have you on and share with our listeners what's going on up here.
There's exciting stuff happening for sure, and it's grown so much since I've started there, you know, 4 years. It's the wonderful thing about gardens. You get to see them change daily, but also you can step back and take a look and just see, wow, you know, like, big changes happen here that you can see, but also like in people, you know.
Yes.
So,
and you have so many different projects just starting from the original vision, mm-hmm. and you're touching the world basically with the ideas, and I understand too that with CAN there's a program of social justice of a sort.
Yeah, so
I was real curious about that.
I can tell you the thing that I know, I would say the most about CAN is their internship piece, which definitely, you know, touches on issues of social justice and global food systems. Mm-hmm. So students, they have CAN set up so there's partner communities. Mm-hmm. So they have one in Nicaragua, El Salvador, Costa Rica, and then there's two sites in Mexico, and those are the newest sites.
How are they established initially? How are these connections made? And it sounds like they're ongoing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so basically CAN came together. Steve Gleisman had several graduate students that he was working with within these different communities. And so basically each of his former graduate students is the liaison within the communities. So they were doing, you know, doing research and work in those communities and realized that, you know, there needed to be, I think, a way to connect the people in those communities and the food they were growing. A lot of it, I think it started basically around the coffee crisis. So folks saw that with the coffee crisis happening, the people in these communities were suffering.
I mean, the price of coffee, and they weren't getting much because there were middlemen.
Exactly, exactly.
And they were not getting what they deserved.
Mm-hmm. And so with CAN, you know, coffee is definitely a big aspect, is they do a fair trade direct market. So instead of, you know, they try to cut out the middle people. Mm-hmm. So you can order your coffee and it gets shipped directly from Costa Rica.
Right.
And what else? Oh, so in terms of the internships, so students can choose to go to any of these communities and intern for, I think a lot of students go for a quarter, which is, you know, 3 months, I think, 2 or 3 months. And the focus definitely, I think, it changes depending on the needs of the community. Mm-hmm. So my understanding, and of course, you know, I don't work for CAN, so hopefully I'm not misrepresenting, but that there's coordinators at each of the communities that work with the students. And so the coordinators communicate with the people in the community and ask, okay, what are the needs of the community? And so if students come, what are projects that they can plug into? You know, how can they serve, basically, rather than students coming in with their own ideas about things that maybe the community doesn't need. And yeah, I think there's, when I was actually down in Costa Rica as a student before CAN existed,
really?
And had just a wonderful experience, just learning so much. You know, you are in school and you learn all these things, and it's very, you know,
from the books.
Yeah, from
cerebral.
The books. Yeah, and then you go
theoretical,
and you meet people, and it totally changes how you think about things and makes everything so immediate and real. And you know, I think a lot of times we can say, oh yeah, everybody should live sustainably and do this and do that, but you know, I think we have to understand
what is sustainable too,
yeah,
relative to the culture that you're living in. I can imagine you must have some very lively discussions around dinner about what's sustainable.
Yeah, and you know, it's
where they've been and
exactly, exactly. You know, and everybody's got sort of a different definition, and you know, I think people that live in Santa Cruz kind of, you know, oh yeah, we ride our bikes and do this and do that, but yeah, I think it's so much more complex, and I think you know, it's important for people to go to other places that are different, you know, and learn from people and try to understand and, I think, broaden your vision so that you can have a better base for, you know, making choices and educating and all of those things.
And I think it's what's unique about your program also, that you don't just talk about, you're not just speaking about sustainability and introducing people to gardening, but you're talking about what it means, what you're doing with your lives in the process.
Mm-hmm.
What did you learn in Costa Rica? What really impacted you?
For me, it was very much so, I went in and I didn't really know what I wanted my project to be. So I was working on my thesis. But I knew I wanted to hear people's stories. Mm-hmm. And I knew that first I had to develop relationships. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's what I learned, is that in order to connect and to learn and to share, you have to first work on being humble and listening and developing those relationships, you know, especially in places where people don't know you. And you have to build trust, I think, on so many levels. And I think even here, you know, within Santa Cruz, when I work with students, it's all about building that relationship and that trust, because, you know, they're not going to care what you have to say if you don't have some sort of connection. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's the big thing that I learned, is, you know, build a relationship and connect with people.
And it's too easy not to connect with people. When you go grocery shopping, I personally am guilty of that. I'll be standing in the line exhausted, mm-hmm. wanting to get ahead of where I am in line, and thinking about, could I ask someone, I only have one item or something. But we're divorced. Uh-huh. I know that I am often divorced from the source of my food, and that somehow translates into, sometimes I have to admit, how I treat others when I'm grocery shopping, and then ultimately the food. Whereas the few times I have been able to have a garden and eat from it, the nurturance is that much greater.
Absolutely.
I had a real stake in what it is I'm eating, the quality of it, and I know where it comes from.
Absolutely. And
I want to share it.
And also, if you know the farmers, you know, that's the wonderful thing about here, is there's so many farmers markets.
I know it.
And farms nearby where you can just go to the farm and talk to the farmer.
I know.
So, you know, we're really lucky where we are. I think there's so much opportunity for you to connect with people and know where your food comes from. Mm-hmm. Even if you don't grow it yourself, you can know the people that do grow it and sort of their philosophy and how they treat the land. Mm-hmm. And I think that, yeah, that's much more meaningful than going to a store and picking up something that's wrapped in plastic and styrofoam, and you don't have
you
any
know how
idea.
How it's been preserved or preserved by what, and it maybe it say organic, but you really don't know.
Right, and what does that mean? You know, just because it says organic, does that mean it's
good? What does
good?
That mean to you?
I'm
curious.
So for me, organic is just kind of like a label, you know, where it's like, okay, we've met these certain standards put out by, you know, whoever's certifying, you know, USDA or Oregon Tilth or whoever. And so, you know, these boxes have been checked, and this is organic. But I think that the way that organic certification is set up now, there's a lot of things that aren't encompassed in what organic means. And I think organic doesn't mean sustainable, you know, and I think a lot of times with organics, there's this focus on, you know, inputs and outputs, right? Like, you can't put in pesticides, and you can't do this, and you can't do that. But it doesn't talk about, well, how do you treat your workers? You know, like, what about long-term ways that you care for the land? You know, I think a lot of times there are organic agribusinesses that are huge, and what they do is more input substitution rather than having sort of a long-term vision of sustainability and caring for a place and a people and, you know, just the environment. So yeah, I think to me, organic isn't as meaningful if I don't know my farmer.
So they don't necessarily even have to be organic.
Right.
It's how they're treating the land and their employees.
I think so. I think so.
Too.
And there are a lot of people that are small farmers. You know, getting certified organic costs money. And for some small farmers, they can't afford it. And so I think that's the key, is sort of like, if you want to know where your food comes from and how it's grown, you have to make that personal connection. Because maybe your farmer doesn't advertise their stuff as organic, but mm-hmm. they're growing it way more sustainably than someone else who Good has point. That label. So I think it's the responsibility of us as consumers, you know, to really, like, make the right choices and be educated and, yeah, I don't know.
And do you make these connections with other farmers in the area?
I definitely I'm try sure. to, you know. So for sure, I personally try to grow a lot of my own food. Mm-hmm. And I make certain choices about what I do and what I don't eat. You know, based on seasonality or, you know, meat versus vegetable, whatever. Mm-hmm. And yeah, if I buy stuff, if I go to the farmer's market, I try to shop from places that I know or have been to. If I go to the store, I look at the label and I try to see, well, okay, is it, you know, because sometimes at the store they say the name of the farm, mm-hmm. or at least it'll say California, you know. So if I was choosing between two avocados, one from California or, you know, one from, I don't know, somewhere Chile or something, right? Yes. So I would choose the one from California. So, you know, it's like I try to do as much as I can. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I think that's, you know, as much as anybody can do is try. And, you know, we're not perfect. We can't all do everything right. But I think as long as
but
the intention is there.
But you're doing a tremendous amount, bringing these students in, training, creating a garden for many, and then coordinating international programs and being involved. Although that may be in the periphery for you, but... Mm-hmm. The many workshops and yeah. constantly educating, but I can see it in your eyes. There's a real passion when you talk about the love of the land mm-hmm. and the vegetables that you're growing. Well, what happens to some of the students when they come in? What would you say their experience? Someone that comes in is a real bookworm, constantly studying, and mm-hmm. just wants to feel the land, get credit for it at the same time.
Yeah, I've seen. Gosh, so many students go through the program. So, of course, there's the academic piece where, you know, there's the class. But then the piece I haven't talked about yet is the residential piece. So, you know, we have a group of about 40 students that live in the village that are part of the PICA residential program. So they live together, they work in the garden, and then they also right. do meals 3 times a week.
3 times a week?
Yeah, and they rotate cooking. So, you know, people... So there's small cook groups and all that kind of stuff. And they also help maintain. So in the village, we have a composting system, and it's the only successfully run, like, student composting system on campus that's been consistent.
Great.
So we're able, I have students in my program that go through in each of the village buildings, and they collect compost buckets that they put out there 2 times a week, and we build... Mm-hmm. In the class or on Saturdays. They have work days every Saturday in the garden. Anybody's invited to come. So you should come.
I will.
And they do lunch together, so there's always food involved.
And it's real important now, too. The price of food is going to be skyrocketing.
Yeah. We have a lot of summer squash right now.
Oh, great.
And plums. Plums are just coming in.
They're real juicy, too.
I should have brought you some. You should come up.
I am. Yeah. Believe me. And I have been looking for... I knew there was a garden project up there. I had no idea how extensive yeah. it was, though. And then we were lost, and I found it before I came in, and I said, I want to know more about what you're doing up here.
Mm-hmm.
And could you come on a radio show and talk about it, and then I can learn even more.
Yeah, so...
No, truly, I've wanted to. All I knew about was the homeless garden and a little bit about
this
program.
Oh, and they do great work at the Homeless Garden Project. Yeah, so...
Do you collaborate with them also?
You know, I have taken students down there and done, like, work days with the Homeless Garden Project. They're an internship site through environmental studies. So we are, you know, connected loosely. Definitely have students that have worked down there and then gotten interested and then, you know, taken the PICA class and things like that. So,
now, what about youth in crisis from inner cities? A friend of mine works in a program up in the hills in Los Gatos, and she's bringing some inner city youth up here Monday mm-hmm. for 2 weeks, and they're going to be gardening some and then learning different native ways.
Mm.
Flint mapping and tanning hides and whatnot. And I mentioned your program.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be a possibility for them to come down, get off the mountain for a day or something? Do you provide that?
So as of now, it's not something that, you know, we have organized.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, one thing is that during the summer, I'm definitely less busy than during the school year. Mm-hmm. And so if it's something that you'd be interested in trying to set up, I would certainly be happy to. That, for me, is one of the reasons.
They would be coming. Their instructors, their teachers are with them.
Uh-huh.
They're also studying.
Uh-huh. Yeah, we can totally talk about it. That's something that's really close to my heart, uh-huh. is, you know, working with young people, especially in urban areas, and young people of color, you know?
They are.
So, for me, I feel like it's important to connect people with the land, but also, like, not everybody can have a farm, and not everybody can have a garden, and a lot of people live in urban areas. So what does that mean? Mm-hmm. And that's something, you know, I did a lot of work as well in San Francisco, just with, yeah, like, connecting young urban people to green spaces and to, you know, healthy food and those kinds of things. So I think it's important to bring those two realms together, right? You know, it's here in Santa Cruz, we have this, you know, this privilege of, like, oh yeah, everybody's got a garden at their school, and, you know, we have 20 farmers markets or whatever.
I know, and community gardens.
Yeah.
We're very fortunate.
Yeah.
But they can garden, I guess, in pots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's certainly, there's container gardening. But I think it's more than just access to land. I think it's also time. You know, it's like some people are struggling to make ends meet and are working three jobs and don't have the time to tend to a garden. You know, not everybody has the luxury of doing a 9-to-5 and making enough money to live off of that.
That's the beauty of community gardening and the program that you have. Everyone works some. I don't know how it works.
Mm-hmm.
Do they commit to certain hours every week, or when they have time? Or?
So our garden is an educational garden. Mm-hmm. It is a community-based garden. But I would say that people don't have individual plots like a community garden you would think about here on, you know, in Santa Cruz, like the Trescany Garden. Everybody shares.
Oh.
So, you know, you put in, and then you're able to harvest out of the garden. And it's all very, you know, community-based. And we use the garden for our class. So, you know, people can harvest from the garden for the community meals involved with the class. Mm-hmm. And then the students that live there also tend to the garden, and so they harvest from the garden for their meals.
And what do you do with surplus food, or if there isn't much?
You know, we don't have much of a surplus with, you know, 40 students living there, and, you know, 40
True.
In the class, and so they take pretty good care of eating everything.
I read of some project, I thought
except
it
for
was
the summer.
UCSC. Oh.
Yeah, during there the summer, there's not as many students around, so I have lots of things.
Hungry students prowling around on the outskirts.
Yeah.
What do you have left over?
Former students showing up and being like, so, is there anything to harvest in the garden?
It's expensive down there.
But yeah, you know, in terms of the summer extra
such
stuff,
thing as leftovers.
You know, whatever
it's
I have extra, I definitely share with staff that are, you know, in Pika and Can, and also in the village. And Life Lab actually is, you know, at the farm, and it's right next to where our office is. And so we have a lot of, like, kids.
What's Life Lab?
Life Lab is basically like a garden-based education program. So there's different Life Lab schools around Santa Cruz, but it was founded, and their sort of main headquarters is at on the UCSC campus. And during the summer, they do like summer camp. So there's kids that come through every day and parents. And so I was thinking about putting out like a bucket with like free organic vegetables and like all the summer squash you can eat and plums and, you know, bouquets of lavender. I think that would be really nice. So I'm going to do that eventually, but yeah.
Sounds like a grand idea.
Yeah, it's nice to share, you know, when you have an abundance.
Oh, it is. It is. There was a program, must be another one, it may be part of the Homeless Garden Project, where you pay $500 for the summer,
mm-hmm.
and then you can pick up a bag
exactly.
of groceries. Bag of groceries is my term.
Mm-hmm.
A bag of whatever was harvested that week.
So that's really common around here. They're called CSAs, which is community-supported agriculture. And a lot of farms do that. So people will buy into a share, and they pay upfront for the season. And
yes,
that
it.
Really helps the farmer, because that means that people are investing.
That's guaranteed.
Yeah, people are investing in you and your work. So no matter what happens with the weather, or if you have, you know, pest damage that wipes out a certain crop, mm-hmm. There is a guarantee that when you start, you're going to have the money to run your farm. Mm-hmm. And so when you buy into a CSA, it's really like you're supporting your farmer and trusting in your farmer.
Now, is it just for the summer, or are they usually year-round?
No, they do them. So some farms do them year-round, but I would say most of them do them during the main growing season. Because, you know, in Santa Cruz, we can grow actually quite a bit of stuff in the winter. But a lot of people end up, you know, cover cropping their fields or something and not doing as much production. I know that up at the farm on campus, they don't do, or at least they didn't used to, do a winter CSA. But yeah, a lot of farms around here do it. And I think that's one of the best ways to really get to know your farmer. And
yes.
A lot of them, they'll have events on the farms where you can come and you can tour the farm, or you can like help harvest things or volunteer. And so it's just a really cool way of getting connected.
I didn't realize there were that many of them here.
Yeah, it's really common. Yeah. I think actually the Homeless Garden Project does a CSA as well.
Do.
Yeah,
they do. That's how I originally heard about it. A friend of mine was getting a bag every week, and then another one from somewhere in Watsonville, I think.
Yeah. So, and I know that some farms also do low income shares. So, you know, that's also another possibility as well. So.
Maybe someone can donate more time in exchange for getting there.
Yeah, or I think maybe, I'm not sure how they fundraise to support those.
Too.
But it might be that, you know, the folks that pay regular pay a little bit more in order to make it available so that people that can't pay the regular, you know, seasonal cost, can still have access to fresh, healthy fruits and vegetables.
That's so important.
Mm-hmm.
Because the food tends to be more expensive, and $500 up front is prohibitive.
Yeah, it really is. It really is, you know. But then if you have that ability and you're able to front that...
For someone else.
Yeah, and you know, not only are you supporting your farmer, you also get, I mean, an amazing amount of food, and it's beautiful, and it's just harvested and has all of its beautiful nutrients in there. And, you know, it's very exciting to, I think, to get something in your basket that you have no idea what it is and learn how to cook
something.
It.
First time I saw quinoa many years ago, I didn't know what to do. And now it's one of my favorite staples.
Yeah, right?
But you mean, it's amazing what I put in it. Last night I just had some with onions and garlic, my favorite.
Yeah, quinoa is great. But yeah, I mean, I'm still scared of kohlrabi, but you know.
What's that?
Kohlrabi, it's it's a brassica, so it's in the same family as broccoli.
Oh.
And it's round, and I don't know how to describe it. It kind of tastes like, a lot of people say it tastes like a broccoli stem, but it's very strange looking.
Oh.
But if you haven't tried it, you should try it.
Have someone blindfold you and then guess what you're eating. That would be a joke. Could be cruel.
Yeah.
Do you have many, do you grow many herbs up there?
Oh, we do, purple. Yeah. So I think I mentioned earlier the herb spiral.
Mm-hmm. You did.
And so we do a lot of like perennial, like culinary herbs, but then... So a lot of the programs or the projects at PICA are student-directed, and so, you know,
each... Depends on the student's interest.
Exactly. Depends on the student interest. You know, I might have somebody come in one year and be really interested in doing a medicinal, you know, a medicinal garden with a bunch of, like, herbs and stuff. And then the next year, nobody might be interested in it, and then it goes into disarray, and, you know, so I think...
It fluctuates.
It fluctuates. Exactly. It fluctuates, and... You know, it's one of the beautiful things about PICA is that there's this possibility for students to bring in their ideas and their enthusiasm and make things happen.
And that's what's so empowering.
Yeah, it's super
you
empowering.
Can do what is in your heart's desire with the land.
Yeah.
That gives them the encouragement to go out in the world and do the same thing. I did it there. Why can't I do it out in the world? And they do, I'm sure.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, with a lot of projects... I try to set it up so that students aren't just working on it by themselves, but, in the process of, say, creating something, they're working with other students and they're teaching other students. So there's that sort of leadership piece as well. It's not just like a solo endeavor.
Just sieves, taking it in and constantly putting out.
Yeah.
It's a learning lab.
Uh-huh. So definitely, it's very much a learning lab, a hands-on learning center, the Sustainable Living Center. Yeah.
Boy, the connections and the friendships that must be made. And then, do you have interns coming from the other community, the other sites? What would you call them, interns?
Yeah, so we haven't had, Can has brought up the internship coordinators from some of the communities, and they do that as, I think, in the winter, and they do a bunch of events around it. They call it the Intercambio. So the internship coordinators come up, but I don't think that they have had groups of, say, young people from the communities come up here and do internships up here. And I think that that's just the way that UCSC is set up in terms of, like, you know, the exchanges. And
if they're not students somewhere else at a university.
Exactly.
Needing credit.
Exactly. But we have done, I would say, was this two or three summers ago, we had a group of students come up from Mexico as part of the Intercultural University. And they stayed at PICA for 2 weeks and basically did, like, an intercultural exchange where we kind of showed them around here. We did gardening stuff around here. But then they also shared with us sort of how they do things there and sort of like a skill swap. And, you know, cooked together, ate together, laughed together.
How rich. I know. There are no... You don't look at the color of someone's skin at all when you're sharing food like that. And you're in the garden all day playing. And you're working, but... The joy that comes out of it.
Yeah.
Picking weeds in the hot, hot sun.
I was doing that earlier this morning.
I know, it was hot today.
It was scorching today.
It was.
Yeah.
Well, what has been the most rewarding for you?
Definitely my students.
Oh.
Yeah, you know, I think for me, I can grow things, and there's joy in seeing, you know, a seed come up and growing something and eating it. But I think the most rewarding thing in the work that I do are the students and how I see the kind of the change that happens in them. And, you know, like, not everybody buys into it and not everybody gets excited about it. Mm-hmm. But those students that do and I connect with later, I really feel like it changes lives. And it's so inspiring to me to see how students take what they learn from PICA and do amazing things and work with other people and share their enthusiasm and their knowledge and their inspiration, you know, on whatever level. It could be on a really small level with just their friends, or they might end up teaching, you know.
Whatever level.
Yeah, or, like, you know, going to another country. It's just... Yeah, that's why I do what I do, is for the students, and because it's totally inspires me every day.
You're just planting seeds for them, our mother. That's what I call the land. You're planting seeds for people's growth, their own growth and development.
Yeah, yeah, and I don't know. It's just super powerful.
It is, and I wonder how that works. Just being on the land, the joy. I know that I feel.
Mm-hmm.
I don't usually garden, unfortunately. I'm going to change that, though, and that's one reason I had you on. But I love hiking and backpacking, and sometimes with others and sometimes solitary. It just feeds my soul.
Yeah.
I don't know how to describe it, being in the wild.
I feel the same way.
Oh, boy.
Totally rejuvenating.
I see a backpack and a sleeping bag, and I get very excited. Mm-hmm. I can see the peaks in the distance, and I'm off.
Yeah, it's just in the Sierras, and it was wonderful.
Oh,
I think the other thing, too, is realizing that that feeds, you know, it feeds us on some level, but it doesn't feed everybody. And I think, you know, there has to be, like, you know, we talked earlier about some people that grew up in urban spaces get really scared when they go out into nature.
I know.
And it's not a comfortable and inviting place for them.
Your program is a bridge.
And so I think, you know, in doing the work that we do, in there has to be that level of, like, understanding and respect for how everybody chooses to interact with nature.
Well said, yeah.
So, you know, it's like...
They can't all be like me. teasing, of course. And that's another thing that that really surprised me as I started going over your website, that there is so much respect. You walk your talk with individual differences. You see the similarities, but you respect the differences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's
and
sort
all
of
the program follows through.
It's like a life lesson, you know? Yeah. It's like on so many levels. Diversity is a thing to be celebrated.
Yes.
So
absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, we're good. This went by quick.
Oh,
very
it's been
quickly.
An hour?
Yes, it
Can
has.
I do a quick plug?
Absolutely. I was just going to ask you about future events,
yes.
Websites.
Great. So at the Sustainable Living Center, we are currently fundraising for a green kitchen. So right now we have all of these amazing gardens and programs, but we don't have a central kitchen where the students are able to come together and, you know, share in cooking of the meals. We have a small kitchen and then one in the village, but what we'd like to create is one that's, you know, green, whatever that means. So a kitchen with a living roof and with solar panels and rainwater catchment and sort of all of those things that, you know, they talk about in green building. We see it there in this, you know, functioning, lively space. And so we just got a grant for $60,000, but it's a matching grant. So we need to raise another $60,000.
By when?
By November.
Doable.
So, yeah, I just wanted to put it out there that this is, you know, this is sort of the piece that brings so many aspects of PICA together and that has been missing. So we're really hoping that we can make it happen.
Where can they send the donations?
So right now, it's semi-convoluted, but you can go to UCSC and they have an online donation form.
Okay.
And so you go under there, there's all these drop-down boxes. So you can, click social sciences, and then you type in other, and you say, you know, PICA Green Kitchen. But if that's, you know, confusing, you can just send me an email or call me.
And what's your email?
Yeah.
So we can do that.
So my email is vvatican, so it's VV. A-D-A-K-A-N at UCSC.edu. Or you can call me. So my office is 831-459-5818. And
if you have any ideas for fundraising projects, maybe a dance or a communal dinner.
Yeah.
And donate all the proceeds to the fundraiser for the Green Kitchen.
Yeah, so please help. I think it'll be such a wonderful learning and community space, and we're really hoping to make it happen. So I'm really excited about it.
And they can visit anytime as well.
Yes, yeah. So, you know, like I said, summer's the best time. I love walking people around and showing people the garden because everything's blooming in the summer. It looks amazing.
And how do you get there again? We were lost, so I don't know where we were.
So we are near the UCSC farm at the entrance to the village. And basically what you do is you drive up the east entrance and then you turn left onto Hagar, which is the road that takes you up to the bookstore. But then you make your first left and that takes you down into the lower quarry. And we're right there at the entrance. My office is in building A1. And you'll
and
see.
And she's there. She's working
you'll
in the garden.
You'll see. You'll just like come in and you'll see where things are blooming. And yeah, I'm more than happy to show people around and talk about the program. So,
yep. Well, thank you so much, Bea. And she's been with us for almost an hour. And this is Bea with the program in Community and Agroecology. That's what PICA stands for, at the village. And it is a village. It functions as a village.
Yeah.
And they are looking for funds, donations, too, for the Green Kitchen. That seems essential, given what you're doing. Well, thank you. And now we're going to play, hopefully, Palestinian news. Thank you for listening. And have a great week.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center. www.imemc.org for Thursday, July 15, 2010. Israeli soldiers get light convictions for shooting a prisoner, and Libyan aid ship docks in Egypt, not Gaza. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. An Israeli court on Thursday handed down its ruling in the case of an Israeli soldier and his commanding officer who shot a restrained and blindfolded Palestinian man with a rubber-coated steel bullet at close range. The attack took place on July 7, 2008. The soldiers accused Ashraf Abu Rahma disrupting the peace before they bound and blindfolded